Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to this episode on the Intellectual History Channel of the New Books Network. Today I'm joined by Dr. Carl Eric Fisher, who is Assistant Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Columbia. This position is in the Division of Law, Ethics and Psychiatry, and he's joining me today to talk about his new book, The Urge, Our History of Addiction, out now by Penguin Press. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Thomas. It's good to be here.
So, I mean, I've read this book and it was absolutely fascinating. It's not an area that I am familiar with in terms of academic literature, but I think what's great about the book is it's very accessible. But before we get to that, I was wondering if you'd tell me a little bit about yourself.
Sure thing. Well, it's particularly relevant in the case of this book, because as you know, the entire book project stemmed out of my understanding of addiction and my felt need to explore what we think we know about addiction, because there's a long history of addiction in my family, and I experienced it myself when I was in medical training. So a little more than 10 years ago, I was graduating Columbia Medical School and going on to psychiatric training also at Columbia, and in some respects felt like I was on a good path and working very hard in my scholarly work and clinical training and doing well to some outside appearances. But then I was also really struggling with alcohol, primarily alcohol, and then later stimulants like Adderall and then cocaine. And throughout my psychiatric training, there were a few moments where people tried to reach out to me and say, you know, clearly something is wrong. You need some help. But I had such a firm idea of addiction that I was defining myself in opposition to, and I was just in basic denial. So I took it to a really extreme point where at one point while on vacation, I went on an alcohol and stimulant binge, and for the first time in my life experienced a manic episode. I became fully psychotic in the sense that I had delusions of spiritual warfare and completely out of touch with reality. And then in this precipitous way, had to go into addiction treatment. And there's a lot more we could talk about regarding that. But the upshot is I faced my own addiction and became comfortable with the notion that, you know, I was the type of person who really should not drink, and that this condition certainly applied for me, that I certainly qualified for addiction. And also I was curious about the nature of addiction and turned to medicine and science, which is tremendous. And I've learned a great deal from. And there seemed to be something missing in some of the medical debates about addiction. And I kept on seeing these trails of breadcrumbs leading back to the humanities, essentially. And as someone who started off in neuroscience research and then later came to bioethics in my own scholarly work, I've always been attracted to philosophy and the humanities more broadly, and feel like medicine can benefit from integrating some of those fields and insights. So when I saw these scholars, psychologists, philosophers, and others continually making these tantalizing references to how, for example, sociology influenced drug policy, and that influenced our governing ideas about addiction, or how psychologists, for example, drew upon ancient philosophy to make sense of a more thorough conceptualization of addiction. I really felt like there was more to learn from all of those fields, but especially history. And that's what set me on this exploration, which was a long process. Again, you asked me about myself. It was a long process of personal exploration, first and foremost, that it came out of a question that I still had in myself of what exactly had gone wrong in me. The medical and the scientific models and theories were useful, but sort of incomplete.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that it really makes the book outstanding, is that it is a really nice weaving together of this personal account, as well as your professional observations throughout your career, but then combined with a historical and, as you say, philosophical and sociological and ethical and at also at times chronological sort of understanding of not only how has addiction been imagined, but what role addiction has been playing or used in terms of this broader, quite nebulous. The book makes very clear that it's in all aspects of life, and many that we don't think about. And I mean, that's something that I realized myself, that this is something that could be quite relevant to everybody that reads it. And not only is it interesting, but it's very contemporarily relevant as a result, as the book talks about rates of incarceration and epidemics in terms of medication. So with that in mind,
I'm glad to hear you say that, Thomas, because I think there's a way that addiction has been framed as if it's some sort of discreetly contained and extreme form of human suffering. And one of the big surprises of the book in terms of an intellectual history was seeing how that's a relatively recent development in the way people talk about and conceptualize mental health, this narrow conception of addiction as if it were the effect of a drug taking over or hijacking someone is no more than a century old. And certainly in the 19th century, and even more so in earlier periods of discussions of these topics, there's a much broader and capacious understanding of addiction as something that exists in all of us and is really a universal expression of certain vulnerabilities in self-control and other related psychological phenomena.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's as I said, that's another thing that really comes across is the length of this. I mean, and the breadth. The work tackles accounts from India, China, ancient Greece. So I was wondering if you just give us a little bit of a background on the early history and the earlier understandings of addiction.
Yeah, one thing that has been useful for me is a framing of the dance between concept and term, in the words of one sociologist I really respect, Robin Room, who's an Australian sociologist who's long worked on alcohol in particular, that we've had the term addiction in the English language for roughly 500 years. That's the term. And so the term is relevant and the term influences the concept. But if we look at the concept of addiction as some sort of powerlessness or a deficit or a problem in self-control, then that is clearly present much earlier. So I trace back thinkers like Aristotle, Augustine of Hippo, and certain other Eastern thinkers, including Gautama Buddha, in the way they thought about self-control in ways that are analogous to our modern conception of addiction. And when I looked at the personal histories and personal accounts of people who struggled with addictive behaviors, I thought there were very clear examples, not necessarily that addiction is something that exists outside of history. And one thing I learned from historians is not to make the anachronistic error of assuming our present understanding of addiction maps neatly onto the past. But even that being said, I found examples of people like a person with clear gambling addiction from 1000 BC, who is described in a hymn in the Sanskrit Rig Veda, someone who was playing at dice, the sort of dicing gambling game that they did in those days was almost totally different. It involved throwing nuts into a pit, and this beautiful hymn that really evocatively describes the push and pull of agency, where at points the person feels like they're in control, but only slightly burdened by their addiction, and other points that the dice are kind of leaping out of the pit and pulling him down into the pit, and the dice themselves acquire an agency that start to affect him. So there are examples like that I think are really striking and quite clear when we think about older models of addiction, and plenty of other examples that we could talk about. You know, there are Chinese poets who describe their fluctuating intentions and their inability to sort of extend their will across time. And then there are plenty of other ancient Greek and ancient Roman examples that are pretty well described and might be more familiar to your listeners. People like Mark Antony or Alexander the Great, who famously struggled with alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, this is another thing that comes through as well, is that this, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, this changing attitude and what is relatively modern in terms of a sort of a condemnation and a sort of almost like a criminalizing of this, where it's been mapping onto, say, personal flaws or character issues or all of these sorts of things. Whereas I think in a lot of the older ones, it's a lot more human. This understanding, and it's a facet of the character rather than a deficiency.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think for me, there was something that was quite soothing and evocative of compassion in recognizing this universal component of addiction. If addiction is something that's present in all of us, and everyone has the capacity to commit themselves to a strong devotion that saps their will, then it doesn't turn into so much of an us-them situation. You and I were talking about good drugs and bad drugs a little bit before we started recording, and that's a major theme of the book, that throughout history, but especially at certain charged moments, people have been divided into good drugs and bad drugs, good drugs and bad drug users, and oftentimes that has nothing to do with addiction. It has nothing to do with the actual risks or dangers of drugs. And in fact, addiction and the broader concept of drug harms is employed as a flexible concept, something that can be deployed in a very compassionate way toward the people we deem good drug users, and deployed as a weapon against people we term bad drug users, and countless examples of that. But it goes back at least to the early modern experience with tobacco, when tobacco was first brought back from North America after Columbus's expeditions. It was reserved as an elite and special, almost magical medicine for the aristocracy. And then as it became associated with commoners and the lower classes, it was then termed barbarous and beastly and savage and like a plague intolerable. So I think that one of the reasons I was interested in exploring those sorts of broader sociological developments, like drug epidemics and social responses to drug epidemics, is oftentimes in those responses to epidemics, we see the governing model of addiction at play at that time. And also we see how the governing model of addiction is shaped by things that are not necessarily related to addiction, that might have more to do with colonialism, oppression, domination, and class struggle. And then we live with the legacy and the stigma of those negative associations. They almost form the prototype of the negative stereotypes of addiction, which we still live with today.
I mean, building from that, I think one of the sort of the forms of addiction that we encounter most in daily life. I would imagine most people are aware of it, or I know someone who is struggling, but also probably one of the most morally and ethically, assessed, whether via religious or social or class-based things, is alcoholism. And this is something that changes quite significantly in how it's understood, right? Especially from like the early modern era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people recognize problems with habitual alcohol use quite early in, certainly, you know, the bulk of the book, although I do include cross-cultural observations, the bulk of the book is about British and then later United States responses to addiction, because in many ways, the United States in the 20th century was the major promulgator of ideas about addiction in the sort of imperialist tendency of a very powerful post-World War II United States dictating biomedical ideas. So anyway, there are great examples of, say, the British gin craze in the earlier 18th century, and then later in the American Revolutionary period, of medical thinkers starting to think quite carefully about habitual drunkenness as a medical problem, as a condition, as a status that endures in a way that is worthy of medical care and concern. But many of those writers, I think, were more flexible and integrative, in the sense that they didn't insist that medicine was the only way or the best way or the fundamental way to understand habitual drunkenness. And I think in some ways the sort of original sin of a lot of these more misguided recent efforts to contain addiction is to essentialize it in a way, to try to put addiction out as if it were some sort of permanent, unchanging essence, that all people with addiction are alike in the same way, that its causes are neatly located in reductionist biology. And that's something that happens much later. I mean, that most of that happens in the 20th century. So regarding alcoholism, you know, before the 20th century, there was not that much of a sense of a division between, we didn't have alcoholism and also addiction. There was a really energetic and lively and interesting late 19th century American inebriety movement, a group of doctors who were quite interested in understanding all of the problems of addiction. And they didn't make such stark divisions between different substances, or even between substances and behaviors, like eating or gambling or sex. But then in large part influenced by what some scholars have called addiction supply industries, a big story of the 20th century was the artificial division between alcohol and tobacco on one hand and so-called other drugs on the other hand. And so one of the major legacies of that is that we today think about alcoholism as if it's different in some essential way, which I think has led to a lot of problems, even just very basic concrete problems in the way we construct our treatment systems.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, because there is this move that's well explored in the book between sort of suggesting that it is a problem with character, that with will and sort of commitment. And I mean, from my own personal knowledge, we see it with the sort of the temperance movement. It's big in the UK, and groups like the Salvation Army and the Methodists are very big in that. But then, and I mean, probably one of the most famous addiction-linked organizations is obviously Alcoholics Anonymous, and they come up with this idea that actually it's not about yourself, is it? It's about something else.
Yeah, I think Alcoholics Anonymous does a really beautiful job of embracing some of the paradoxes around addiction. For people who are not familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, it arose in, say, the 1930s, 1940s United States, and part of the core of the program is not just meetings, it's also a series of steps, the eponymous 12 steps of the 12-step programs. And there's a first step that says that people are powerless And then the second and third step, sort of paradoxically, it says that one has to turn it over to a higher power. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous has been represented as a fully secular organization, as a spiritual organization, as a religion unto itself. And, you know, I think it's a really fascinating sort of example of a basically anarchic, decentralized organization where there's tremendous variability among its practitioners. So one of the ways that they embrace one of the paradoxes around addiction is this sort of insistence on personal responsibility on one hand, while also insisting on this sort of surrender and acceptance that it seems in opposition. It's essentially a spiritual notion that how can you focus so much on personal effort and also speak so centrally about powerlessness and the need for outside salvation. So, I think Alcoholics Anonymous as a sort of intellectual and religious and also quasi-therapeutic mutual help development is a really interesting amalgam of the medical, the psychological, the spiritual, and also a sort of like early secular humanist approach to recovery and service as well. So, there's a lot more we could say about that, but just to say, you could probably tell that I'm a big fan of AA. You know, like in some ways it saved my life. I was mandated to a 12-step based rehab program in my own life. And also, I saw a lot of problems in the contemporary treatment system, which are also related to the way people have understood AA, that in many ways, the subsequent developments around advocacy and the way people advocated for certain types of addiction treatments resulted in a very harmful one-size-fits-all model, which has really done a tremendous disservice. And again, in connections to the criminal legal system, has led to massive and powerful systems of control that really deserve a lot of undoing today.
And it was in the section about AA that you start to unpick some of the gender issues as well, because especially with alcohol, there's a very big divide between how alcoholism is viewed when attached to a woman or attached to a man, and there's an extra level of moral judgment which goes beyond the class, right?
Absolutely. Oh, it's so. I mean, the gender issues in the history of addiction are so fascinating because it goes back ages and intersects with ideas about fatalism and motherhood and genetics. I mean, some of the earlier examples go back to the gin craze in 1720, 1730, 1740 in Britain, where a big part of the moral panic around gin was not just that gin was more available and that gin was more available to a poor and rapidly expanding urban underclass, but also that women were significantly involved in not just gin consumption, but gin trade, that poor, unattached women were pushing around gin carts through London. And that was seen as evidence of depravity and the corrupting power of gin. And then we see ideas about gender again in the 19th century degeneration theory and early ideas about evolution, these notions that women who drank during pregnancy would sort of pickle their babies and cause a sort of future class of a bio underclass, that people would be somehow ruined and their children would be fated to vice, essentially. And it's just remarkable how these messages about gender echo and echo across time. Certainly in AA and in the 1940s, 1950s US, there were a lot of really stigmatizing and misogynistic ideas about women drinkers, but also in the crack epidemic in the 1980s, the story of so-called crack babies and crack mothers was so powerful. And was really based on shoddy science, or at least very provisional science that was taken up to be much more firm than it actually was. And it really was, at the time, I think, well-meaning people, well-meaning scientists, at least, were trying to raise the alarm about the potential dangers of crack, which did have, I mean, there was a moral panic around crack, but there were also real harms from crack as well. But these well-meaning people in the process were, without realizing, replicating these stories about female drug use over time. So, you know, that's another big theme of the book is, especially for me as a medical professional and a researcher, to see all the ways that scientists seemingly unwittingly just pick up and replicate and sort of like retrofit the prevailing social norms onto supposedly objective scientific conclusions, I think is just a really important message for anybody who's engaged in science and technology studies. And it's probably obvious for people who are familiar with history, but I think my profession sometimes doesn't do that great a job of it.
Yeah. I think what was also interesting is, first of all, from this, shall we say, backseat or maligned role, we also see women taking a lead in a lot of addiction, either combating or discussion or just general awareness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the best example there is Marty Mann. This woman I thought is tremendously fascinating, a mid-century alcoholism advocate who was one of the early participants in AA, was one of the first people in LA in AA who were LGBTQ. And she was, fascinatingly a closeted lesbian, Republican, wealthy socialite, advertising maven, who is largely forgotten today in no small part because people sort of valorize Bill Wilson and Bob Smith, the male founders of AA. But Marty Mann played this really fascinating role in a way that is contiguous with the role of women in earlier prohibition and temperance movements, but by coming forward and talking not so much about the problems of the home, but in her case, talking about her own struggles with alcoholism, was a tremendously powerful advocate for remediating a big, big problem, which is its own topic, the medical profession's essential abandonment of people with addiction in the earlier part of the 20th century. At the time that Alcoholics Anonymous and Marty Mann were around, it was very difficult for even people, even wealthy, well-connected people with alcohol problems had a lot of trouble getting treatment, to say nothing of people with opioid addictions and other addictive problems. So she did a tremendous, tremendous job of raising awareness and the forcing open the doors of hospitals and arguing for insurance coverage. There's certainly something gendered in that too, that her position as a woman allowed her to speak with some authority and ability around that.
When we think about these two racial examples, and these are ones that stood out to me, I'm not sure how familiar people are with the long-lasting effects of this sort of stigmatization, especially when it's based upon race, which then links into this idea of good drugs, bad drugs. I mean, there are two examples of opioids and of cocaine that do have this seemingly race and class driven binary of acceptability and, shall we say, depravity or immorality. So this is something the book covers. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about this, because I mean, this is something that I found fascinating. I'm sure I read as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and taking those in reverse order, I think more people comparatively are familiar with the history at the turn of the 20th century, when fears about Black people in the United States and fears about supposed Black violence and this almost almost, again, paradoxical idea that both simultaneously Black people were more vulnerable to the effects of drugs, but also that they got more strength from drugs, particularly cocaine, led to really repressive criminal justice policies around drugs and around addiction. And that in many ways formed the stereotype of the depraved and violent and unreliable and irredeemable drug user that has remained institutionalized in much criminal justice policy. And it's really extremely important. And I think many, even academic histories, at least in my own field, and if you read a psychiatry journal that makes a reference to drug history, it often starts around that time. Not without reason. I mean, it might date the arc of drug policy to, say, the 1910s, 1920s, where the Harrison Act started, and frames it almost as if it were the Dark Ages, and then only later in mid-20th century, enlightened medical actors came around and informed the world that, no, we could think of this as also a medical problem, and brought more compassion. And that's sort of a funny framing, actually, yeah, probably just because most physicians and people focused on the contemporary period don't look back to the 19th century. But that first example you brought up of the introduction of opium and opioids to the United States is so fascinating, because we could even go back to Thomas De Quincey and the English Romantics, who, of course, famously had this luxurious recreational use and subsequent problems with opium. And then the United States in the earlier to mid part of the 19th century was quite arrogant. Surprise, surprise. The United States was arrogant about their position in the world. But they said, we probably won't have those types of problems that Thomas De Quincey and Samuel Taylor Coleridge had, and we will pursue these drugs in a more scientifically rationalist way. There was a massive enthusiasm for synthetics. This was the time that, or not synthetics, excuse me, a lot of enthusiasm for purified drugs that, this is the time that morphine was isolated, and there were advances in the way that people processed and transported cocaine, such that a new wave of supposedly modern drugs were able to be marketed to the American consumer. So morphine and other opium products were considered a very good drug, a white drug, a drug that was rational and modern and pure. And simultaneously, in the wake of a massive Chinese migration to the United States, in part instituted by military actions of the Opium Wars, which are traceable back to British and American imperialist economic ambitions, so many Chinese migrants were flooding into the West Coast of the United States that it prompted this vicious xenophobic backlash, which in many places centered quite strongly around opioids. That smoked opium, for example, which is predominantly used by Chinese people, was considered worse and more addictive and more harmful than, say, for example, injected morphine. When injected morphine is, despite the fact that it's predominantly used by white and comparatively wealthier folks around that time, is much more powerful in terms of producing physiological and psychic effects. So we see this progression of powerful laws aimed not so much at addiction, but at particular types of drug users. So the first federal legislation about opium exclusion was specifically targeting smoked opium, targeting the type of opium use that was associated with Chinese immigrants. So around that time, there are other racist and xenophobic elements we could talk about here too, but just to keep it short, there is this Western obsession with Chinese opium smoking in the South, in particular, this deep, deep concern about Black people and cocaine use. And then in the East, a bit later, as there is this massive urbanization and European immigration, the use of illicit opioids and then later heroin became associated with the urban poor in the larger cities of the East. And so the country was almost hemmed in by all of these like frightful and panicked ideas about the wrong sorts of drugs and the wrong sorts of drug users. And one of the important conclusions and themes throughout the whole book is the way that that panic, those series of panics, and the way that they led to harsh prohibition and criminalization of drug use eventually redounded to hurt everyone, that it massively undercut the otherwise compassionate efforts to bring addiction treatment and treatment of drug problems to everyone. And so even though people tried to maintain this sort of two-tiered system where white upper-class users still maintained access to treatment, it all essentially fell apart, such that, like what we were talking about before, by the time Alcoholics Anonymous rolls around in 1930s, 1940s, even the most wealthy and well-connected people couldn't access quality treatment.
Yeah, and this race and class element plays through again, as well as the compassion element. In the book, you start to talk about how a number of figures have clearly influenced this, and some of the figures that stood out were those that were involved in early methadone treatment, and how that worked, and obviously that pans out in a very class and race based way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'll give a shout out actually, because just yesterday there was a post on this great blog called Points, which is the Society of the History of Alcohol and Drugs. Their blog, I'm sure it's an acronym, but I don't remember what it is. But Emily Dufton, who's a drug historian, wrote a bit more about methadone. And there's some great specialized literature about methadone and the early days of methadone. And that's sort of one of the meta stories about the book, Thomas, actually, is that, when I started exploring the history of drugs and the history of addiction, there's so much great specialized literature, but it tends to focus on such a narrow slice of life. And many of those works are beautifully written and really lovely. But what I was looking for was a way of connecting some of these themes overall. So about methadone, methadone for me in the United States, growing up in New Jersey and New York, is associated with these dingy and sort of, again, vice districts. It's the sort of 21st century version of a vice district, where I picture a methadone clinic and I picture something that looks like a fortress with people lined up early and lots of street dealing around the vicinity, and people who are not like really in strong recovery around it. That's a stereotype. That's a stereotype that has caused immense amounts of stigma against medications for addiction treatment, which is a massive tragedy because we're living through a historic crisis of overdoses every day. And I mean, not even because of my time in recovery, but just my personal life as a person who grew up in the United States in the 80s, 90s, 2000s. Stories of people who have horrific opioid problems and overdoses and deaths. And there's so much we could be doing to remediate that crisis if we could overcome some of the stigma that's associated with these medications. Methadone in the outset was a really serendipitous discovery, like a lot of medical scientific discoveries are, basically a metabolic researcher who was not studying drugs at all and a psychotherapist came together, Dolan Nicewander, we're just initially trying to understand how different drugs worked and happened upon methadone, which has such a long method of action it stabilized people and took away their cravings and allowed them to be protected against overdoses and live productive lives. And one of the big surprises of the book was that in the rehabilitative 60s into the Nixon years, there was this sort of bipartisan curiosity about the use of methadone, that maybe we could enact methadone in medical settings in a sort of holistic manner, meaning it's not just about providing a drug, but also about providing really strong social services and vocational services and helping to support people in their own goals and giving a sort of warm and therapeutic locus for community and for care. And there's even one scholar who called Nixon the first therapeutic president because he did such a great job of supporting some of these drug treatment efforts. And of course, there is this sort of double talk because there's also really, really harsh racist rhetoric coming out of the Nixon administration, which ultimately undercut some of these efforts. And methadone became more of a tool of crime control. Its fundamental justification was supposedly normalizing people and disciplining them to the way that authorities wanted them to be, rather than meeting them in a compassionate, therapeutic way and supporting them in their own goals. And so a series of the quite harsh and restrictive and counterproductive regulations led to the methadone system that we have today in the United States. And I had the experience that a lot of physicians have in the United States, where many other countries are much more flexible with methadone. But in the United States, people have to come every single day, and they come in the morning, and there are these really restrictive programs. And, you know, there's certainly ways that methadone programs have problems in other countries as well. But there's a particularly American legacy of racism and prohibitionism that has impacted medicine, that impacted methadone specifically, that once again is a cautionary tale about how when these efforts, and these holistic and therapeutic efforts, become corrupted by these broader agendas, it undercuts the whole system and redounds to hurt everyone.
So another takeaway I had about this as well is this the way that the understanding of self-control plays a role, because I mean when you were talking about the 60s and 70s of the United States, obviously as many people be familiar with, there is this influx of heroin, especially with Vietnam veterans, and what was really surprising to me was first of all the scale of it. I mean, obviously, as someone that is not from the United States but has an understanding of a surface understanding of the history, I was aware of it, but I wasn't aware of the scale. But there's another element that I'll leave it to you to talk about that was really surprising.
So, you know, another element of the Nixon era efforts to respond to addiction and drug problems was this panic. One second. Let me just deal with this. Yeah. Well, let me put it this way, that, you know, Nixon had an issue with drugs even in the early days of his presidency, but it really intensified as the morass in Vietnam progressed. And by a certain point, there is a massive, massive wave of heroin use among servicemen in Vietnam. And it's a really fascinating window into the way that people have understood different drug problems, because I'll tell you, people across the political and ideological spectrums have interpreted this phenomenon in such divergent ways. And it's a great object lesson in being very careful and humble about how we interpret these types of phenomena and these types of natural experiments, because the natural experiment that came out of this experience was as servicemen returned from Vietnam, after having been using heroin, sometimes in massive quantities, there was a huge panic that they would say, oh, motherfucker. So the experience of heroin in Vietnam was such a fascinating phenomenon and fascinating natural experiment. There was a massive problem of heroin use among American servicemen in Vietnam, which I should mention was in part a function of the way that American imperialist military ambitions destabilized the region and actually promoted the trade in heroin, not to mention just the generally miserable conditions that prompted people to alleviate their suffering with drugs. But so there was a moral panic back stateside that American servicemen who were supposedly hooked on heroin would come back and infect their local communities, that they would somehow not only come back and be a social problem, but that they would be the locus of a spread of a sort of unstoppable heroin addiction. And so part of the, not Nixon himself, but some of the policies that Nixon put in place, like the a special office for drug abuse prevention, actually gave a fair amount of latitude to some forward-thinking scientists and physicians and policymakers who decided to study this problem. To study what would actually happen when people who had a significant heroin use history came back to the United States. And I should also say that it's a fascinating window into the way people understand and spin drug problems, because across the ideological spectrum and across the political spectrums, people have used this example in all variety of ways. So many competing and contradictory interpretations of this natural experiment of Vietnam returnees. But the upshot is that there was a psychiatric epidemiologist named Lee Robbins at the Washington University in St. Louis, which is a, for folks who don't know, a really fascinating epicenter of a biological and sort of rationalist and empirical study of mental disorders, especially around that time in the 1970s. So Lee Robbins was tasked with studying the natural history of people with heroin problems around that time. And the shocking thing that they found, which is related to other scientific results in different fields, including alcoholism research, was that a massive number of people seem to get better on their own without any treatment, even that people without any sort of meaningful engagement in treatment services or otherwise just simply stopped their use when they came back to the United States. And, again, I want to be really careful and clear here, because I think especially for your audience, they would probably be interested in some of the nuance. I mean, there were funny ways about the ways that Robbins and her team classified addiction. It was a very biologically based description of habituation and withdrawal, which, nowadays I think most people would say is not the sine qua non of addiction, that it probably involves something, beyond just being tolerant on a substance, although there is that legacy of confusing physiological dependence with addiction. And also there were some contingencies in place where the returning veterans had strong incentives to not use, because if they tested positive on their return, then they would have to be mandated to like a certain like drying out detox time. But the upshot is that study plus other studies cast doubt on what was at the time the reigning model of addiction, which said that once you were hooked, you're an addict for life. That once an addict, always an addict, in the words of the writer William Burroughs. And that in particular, that these more dangerous drugs, these supposedly more dangerous drugs like heroin, and in some ways actually more dangerous drugs, caused a sort of irreversible, uncontrollable addiction. And findings like that sent shockwaves through the treatment industries and through the scientific discussions of addiction as a disease. And, to this day, it's a really charged and polarizing topic. What is the actual nature of addiction? In many ways, that's the set of questions that set me on the study of these topics in the first place, is what do we actually know about addiction? The sort of governing model that it's permanent and unchanging and all addicts are alike in the same ways, that these are once like very deeply held in our folk psychology, and also there are these seemingly contradictory scientific pieces of evidence, and how do we reconcile them? And so if there are these contradictions, then what is addiction anyway? So a really fascinating and interesting time period, because in some ways nothing has changed in the public discourse. We're still having similar fights about addiction. And I think one piece of the solution would be to pause and be more humble about what we think addiction is, and to let go of really firmly fixed views about addiction as an essential condition that exists almost as if it's its own natural kind.
Yeah, and I mean, this brings me to the sort of the final point, and it's one of the final points of the book, is you explore this, all the various models of rehabilitation and all like the zero tolerance approaches and how this is taken societally. And I mean, you've touched on this with regards to methadone, and you touched on this just now with regards to how the veterans were treated as well, or their incentives. And I think, I suppose this is an area that, and it's another sort of taken for granted area, right? People assume that rehabilitation is a one size fits all model, and actually it is a product, like everything, of socioeconomic, sociopolitical, legal, and sometimes like religious or moralistic viewpoints that have shaped what rehabilitation has taken the form of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there are even examples that I describe in the history of people who were very committed to alcoholism advocacy around the mid-century, who then became really cautious and even outright fearful of the direction, the ideological direction, some of the treatment industry was taking. So Harold Hughes was a former senator, at one time considered a likely presidential candidate, who was a person in recovery. He was sort of like a former truck driver who had really bad problems with alcohol and then found recovery through AA, and was instrumental in a lot of the Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon era alcoholism legislation in the United States. And also instrumental in the way that treatment systems were set up. And in many ways, this was a positive development, that there was a great deal of access being provided that wasn't being provided before to people who had alcohol problems and who were looking for some sort of therapy or medical help. And he eventually himself came to call it a treatment industrial complex, because he saw how concentrated power and profit motive, or even just prestige and status, created a sort of ideological rigidity within the field. And that's indeed what happened, that in part because of the vacuum of medicine that we described before, in part because medicine had in many ways abandoned the treatment of addiction earlier in the 20th century, the treatment industrial complex sort of ossified into a one-size-fits-all model that said Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way, to the point where in the 1980s, when there was this huge craze for recovery, in part in the wake of former First Lady Betty Ford coming forth and talking about her own experience in recovery, in the wake of this huge craze for recovery, there are quotes of directors of rehab saying, "I can tell you one thing, if you don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous after you leave this place, you won't make it." And it's just a preposterous notion. I mean, we've known for years, and we certainly know today, that there are many pathways to recovery. And it's really great that I would say even within the last 5 years in the medical and the policy world, there's much more receptiveness to this notion of multiple pathways of recovery. And it's a little bit depressing, because we've had good science about this since at least the 1980s, and in some ways we could intuit it, or at least give a sort of more pluralistic model a try in the 1970s. So that's just one example of many in the book of the way hubristically and arrogantly thinking about the proper way to recover has not really served us well.
I mean, I think that's a really great way to sort of be tying things up as well, because it is this, like much of the book, this sort of Janus-like approach of looking to the past and to the future. And usually for, I think, a historically focused book, there is this element of hope and an open-mindedness with a lack of prescription for solutions, just a sort of exhortation to not be narrow-minded about these things. So yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that the listeners will be from their various fields will all find very different things to take away from the book, because I know I did. So with that in mind, and the book recently published, I thought it's worth asking, have you got anything else planned for the near future?
Well, yes and no. COVID is a bit of a struggle with a six-year-old, and I'm not putting a lot of pressure on myself to jump right into another enormous project, because this one took me 10 years, and especially bringing it to a close during the pandemic was just rough. And so I don't want to have some sort of preconceived idea about like what the next thing is, but I'm in Portugal right now. I'm in Lisbon, Portugal, and part of that is personal, but then part of that is also professional, in that Portugal, as a lot of folks will know, is a sort of a test case for a really interesting drug policy that they have done a really interesting set of reforms around decriminalization to address their own drug problems, going back 20 years, going back to 2001, where they decriminalized all drugs for personal use. And that's another, it's funny that we're talking about this, because just like the example of servicemen returning from Vietnam, people have used the Portuguese experience in a variety of ways across the ideological spectrum. And so some advocates say this means that we should absolutely decriminalize everything right away, because the Portuguese have been very successful. And then at the other end of the ideological spectrum, people attribute it to some of Portugal's criminal justice policies and its social conservatism, and say that it could never work in the United States or elsewhere. I had the sense, in part, inspired and stemming out of my work on writing this book, that the social and cultural and historical roots of the Portuguese experience with drugs was really important and often overlooked. That one of the things I'm exploring right now is how is it that the Portuguese experience with living under a dictatorship for a good portion of the 20th century affect the drug crisis. How did their experience with the Rei Tornados, which was this phenomenon of people in the formal colonies returning in massive numbers and causing a lot of urban strife and stress in the 1970s, how did that play into the whole situation? And certainly social and cultural legacies going back far beyond then. So I'm just really curious about the broader synthetic and interdisciplinary looks at issues like this that tend to be studied in isolation. So, I don't know if it'll be a book or just an article or what, but I'm curious to learn about it.
I mean, that sounds fascinating. And I'm sure, as I say, our readers and listeners will be very interested in keeping track of the developments with that. So on that note, I would like to thank you for appearing today on the New Books Network. And just a reminder that this book, that Dr. Carla Rick Fisher's book, is The Urge, Our History of Addiction, and it's out now on Penguin Press. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Thomas. Great talking with you.